correct. This is Red Eyes Radio. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, Northern Europe. Welcome and thank you for tuning in today. RedEyesCreations.com is our website where you can follow our news, radio programs, TV episodes, insight videos, and more. And as you know, if you're a regular listener, we cover a lot of different research, and we hope you will find it interesting to learn about all of it. We also question all the artificial constructs, and that means going up against a well-funded propaganda machine that is designed to keep us locked in a politically correct prison, where history is rewritten constantly with the aid of entertainment media, education, and academia, where the facts are skewed to fit a world designed for control, where reality doesn't apply, and where the elite conspire with the aid of the useful idiots against those who would be threatening the established order of the day. We have an introductory program for you today on the cosmology, belief system, and way of life by the indigenous Europeans in Scandinavia. From Norse folk belief and myth to the gods of the Viking Age, we are going to cover a time span over many hundreds of years today. We're also going to straighten out some stereotypes and talk about the wonders and importance of reconnecting with your ancient roots, whatever area of the world you are from. To do this, we have Stephen McNallan with us from North America. He's behind the Asa True Folk Assembly and the website runestone.org. McNallan was one of the earliest advocates of reconstructing Old Norse folk beliefs in modern times. And as you might or might not know, Asa True is an expression of the pre-Christian spirituality of Europe. More specifically, it's the way by which the Germanic peoples have traditionally related to the divine and to the world around them. It's a delight to have you with us, Stephen. Thank you so much for coming on, talking with us today. How are you today?
I'm fine, Henrik. Thank you. And thank you for having me here.
Well, you bet. And it might seem bizarre, if that's the right term, to bring on a citizen resident of America to talk about something specifically Northern European here. But the fact is, I think that Stephen is a great person to open up this topic for us as well on this program on Red Eyes Radio. We've talked, you know, with a few potential folks from Scandinavia to get on, you know, the program as well. But the fact is, some do have language issues, you know, it's a little bit more difficult with English for some. And some are also a little bit too bit academic to begin with. And I think that someone like you, Stephen, is great because you're just not studying it like the scientists in that regard are, but you actually, or you're someone who's incorporated it into your life in a different way. You actually live with some of this stuff, and therefore, I think you make a prime candidate to come on, Stephen. So thank you again.
My pleasure.
So before we get kind of deeper into the various components of Norse mythology, this ancient European belief system, and specifically then Asa True as well, what drove you to kind of get into these topics, Stephen?
Well, about 40 or 45 years ago, I was a young college student. It was the late 60s, although I hasten to add that in rural Texas, where I was going to school, and I am in fact a native Texan, this was not the revolution of the 60s. It was actually very conservative in many ways. I was a young man, early 20s, very oriented at that point in my life towards what I thought might be a military career. So I was in Reserve Officer Training Corps at a time when that was very unpopular in the United States. I was always a little bit outside the mainstream in that it was something of a nonconformist, which I know sounds very strange for someone with military inclinations, but that was me. I was a great fan of a genre of fiction called sword and sorcery, sort of fantasy with a barbarian flavor to it, like the writings of Robert E. Howard, for example, who wrote the original Conan stories and so forth.
Oh, yeah, fantastic stuff.
Great stuff, and, you know, it hit me at just the right point of my life because I was all about testosterone and heroism. You know, that was really where I was at. And I was in the dormitory at college one day, which would have put it in my freshman or sophomore years, and I ran out of books to read. Well, this is a crisis. So I put on my shoes and walked a couple of miles over to a little bookstore several miles away and The place where I went to get these books was sort of a mom-and-pop grocery, back before there were really what we now call convenience stores. And I remember this haggard-looking old man kind of ran it. And he had groceries and knick-knack and snacks and various and sundry. But off in this corner, he had this dusty pile, piles, I should say, of secondhand paperbacks. And this was where I would go when I was looking for something interesting to read. And I ran across one book. I picked it up, and at first I thought it was in this sword and sorcery genre. But, well, no, here's this guy, and he's got this funny-looking helmet on, and he's swinging this big sword, and at the top it said the Vikings. Well, I didn't know much about Vikings, except that they were big and tough and swung swords. So I walked out of there with that book. It wasn't great literature, although it was a bit of a piece of its time. It was probably written in the 1950s by a man named Edison Marshall, who wrote a lot of historical fiction back in that day. By the time I finished that book, which took place at that intersection of Christianity and the old beliefs, I knew which side I was on. And it wasn't the side of the missionaries. Now, I understand that anything I run across in a novel is going to be simplistic and, after all, to some extent, at least imaginary. But nothing that was central to that book has changed really in all of these years. I mean, it was rather well written, and I think the man captured the era very well. It contrasted a way of life that was vital, energetic, committed, focused on honor and on deeds, with something that was more submissive, that was all about surrendering, becoming one with, giving up, becoming one with God, or all of these things. And this was hard for me because I've been raised in a very Christian household, but I knew which side I was on, and I have followed that way ever since.
People love Viking stuff. I mean, just the stories themselves of ancient peoples, heroic times, you know, brave men and women for that matter too. And whenever we link something like this up on the website, it gets tons of hits. You know, people, it's almost like people long for something like this of a, to a certain degree, a simpler time perhaps, but also a different way completely of life than we're accustomed to. And this is something that I want to try to get a little closer to during the program as well, Stephen. But just to kind of set the stage a little bit here, what do you think happened in Europe in this particular time? Because I think that that's an essential point that you bring up. Just when Christianity is kind of coming in, and the way that for at least a couple of extra 100 years or so, the expansion of the Roman Empire had been halted by that victorious battle there in northern Germany, pretty much, where that seized the expansion further up north, and the Norsemen was still allowed, if you will, to carry on for quite some time with their own customs and ideals before later in the, you know, 10th or 11th century or so, Christianity really began to coming in through the king lines and the different, you know, missionaries and so that came in. But how did we lose that? But by what method did the Christian church manage to spread the way it did and get such a stronghold even up in Northern Europe?
Well, I think, first of all, it's important to realize that probably several different factors were playing a role here. When historians write about the Viking Age, that outbreak, that burst of energy and conquest and colonization that characterizes the Vikings, they usually focus in on these sort of sociologically and historically approved, tried and true things. They talk about population, they talk about weather, they talk about the need for more land based on the social customs of the day and so forth. And I'm not saying that's not true, but some historians are looking at something else going on there. For example, there's a fellow named Robert Ferguson who wrote a book simply called The Vikings, A History. Came out perhaps, I don't know, some 2 years, something like that ago. He says outright that the Viking raids were at least partially a response to the hostile and aggressive actions culturally, politically, socially on the part of the missionaries.
Absolutely.
And it was no coincidence that the first Viking raids were against the missionary centers, places like Lindisfarne and many of the larger churches. Sure, you can always say, well, you know, that's where the gold was, and that's true. But he suggests that there was something else going on there, and that there was really a conflict of cultures. There we go, Huntington again.
Yeah.
Clash of cultures. Well, this is the one that set the stage for a lot of it. So I think that as the Roman Empire, with all of its infrastructure, its roads, its bureaucracy collapsed and kind of fell back in on itself, I think that in many ways Christianity took on that mantle, that in effect it became the new Roman Empire. And it was aggressive, it was not compromising except for tactical purposes, and it was a direct threat to not just what we think of as the Vikings, but a whole northern European, and for that matter central European, ethos, a way of honor, a particular way of looking at the world that was directly opposed to that of the church's mission.
You bring up a good point as well here. Obviously, it's one that I've made for a long time, just the idea that this is a retaliation against the invasive force. And of course, it can be speculated why they chose England, let's say, in the initial attacks than some of the other points further down in the south of Europe. But that happened later too. I mean, remember even Ragnar Lodbrok, he went down to as far down as to Paris, you know, and went down there. But this idea, let's just tackle this idea first, that we are talking about just a ruthless, completely idiotic set of quote-unquote barbarians. They basically had nothing else to do. There are just a tremendous material that is coming out now in terms of what type of sciences they had, the way that they actually also, it was not only raiding, it was they had vast trade routes, even down to Constantinople through the Volga trade route, possibly even so far down to northern Iran, where they managed to bring up some of the ironwork and everything else. But there is so much more going on there than just the raids itself. So what would you say to this idea that they were just barbarians and that was it, Stephen?
That's a vicious stereotype, and it's simply not borne out by the facts, much of which you've just cited. I have actually seen those runes that are carved in Hagia Sophia in Istanbul, mm-hmm. the ones that are up on the balustrade there. I found out about them through an old article in National Geographic, and when I showed up for several days in Istanbul, formerly Constantinople, I sought those out, and apparently it says something like Haftan, and then the rest of it's largely indecipherable. And the fellow who wrote that was probably a member of the Varangian Guard, you know, the emperor's chosen bodyguard. So these are actually rather sophisticated people that made their way around the world. Went to lots of interesting places. They were not narrow-minded. They were not ignorant. They certainly understood the basis of rational thought. There are plenty of comments in the sagas that make this clear. They're greatly underestimated. But at the same time, they are only the tip of the iceberg, appropriately, in many respects. I mean, there's much more to Germanic prehistory than that. But in many ways, the way the Vikings was the best and also flawed in some ways, but it was a good, energetic recapitulation, I think, of the spirit of Northern Europe.
Absolutely, and again, then the amber trade itself, just the way that of the ships that they developed, the maritime culture that rose up at it. I mean, that's just incredible in itself. It set the precedence for, you know, many, many years, including the Ulfbert, the sword, of course, which is just, I mean, there was nothing in Europe like that for another 800-900 years, perhaps even. This is a tremendous achievement in metallurgy and everything else.
That's true. And in fact, for any of your listeners who are interested in that, I think there's a Netflix download, a documentary about those swords that goes into a lot of detail about the metallurgy and their development.
Absolutely. Now, what would you say, too, if we go back a little bit further now, because the Viking Age is still as impressive and interesting that is in itself, that's still also fairly late in the process, shall we say. This is, again, they're a couple of hundred years from the first attacks in Lindisfarne, then you basically have a beginning of a Christianization, and then things begin to change a little bit from that point. But what do you know, and what would you say about the culture that preceded the Viking era. And Viking, by the way, simply means, you know, to go on a quest or a mission. It means to go on adventure, pretty much. That's what they did. And raids, too. It's more used as a verb, I think, at that point than anything else. But what do you know about the culture that came before that?
I think that the cultures, plural, that came before that were pretty much logical predecessors. I believe you've mentioned in your writings, you know, the Vendel period, and of course the Goths are extremely significant.
Yeah.
And so forth. I mean, these are typical, tribal groupings of the pre-Viking age people of Northern Europe. I think that there is a general continuity that seems to run throughout. I mean, things develop and change over time, goodness knows, but I think that the basic attitude, worldview, spirit, whatever you want to call it, seems to be rather constant.
Let's talk a little bit more about the belief systems here as well, then, and what has been in place there for thousands and potentially thousands of years, and just the idea that Christianity is a fairly newcomer onto the scene, even in these days. Also true is a distinct, you know, field of course in itself. And when I began to look into this, you realize that this is just one component of a larger picture and one that's been pretty complex as well to try to deconstruct and understand. But just the basic idea that we've had for a long time, three different classes of gods, if you will, the Asar or the Asir, you have the Vanir, and then you have the Alvir as well. There's three different classes there. Is there something particular, Stephen, that kind of attracted you to the Asir as opposed to the other two classes?
Initially, my view of Northern religion, specifically the religion of the Viking Age, was filtered through the fact that I was about 19 or 20 years old and that, again, testosterone-laden, and I was hankering for a future career, which, thank goodness, never materialized, in Army Special Forces or something of that sort. For me, initially, I didn't even know the word Asatru at that time. You know, the Odin, you know, the way of Odin, as it were. Odin was always my god. He's always the one I focused in on. And it's true but superficial to look at Odin as a god of the warrior. But actually, he is a god of wisdom. He is a god of transformation. He is a god of becoming. And that was very appealing to me in all of its different aspects. Now, as the years went by, I started to realize, there's more to it than this. This is not just a warrior cult. A warrior is not the society per se. He is a part of the society and serves the society. And I began to discover the goddesses and to realize their profound importance as the givers of life. And I began looking at you know, the larger picture. So my own views actually evolved greatly over time, to the point that I think, now I look back at that young lad of 19 or 20, and I think he didn't really know very much, but his heart was in the right place. I'm still definitely an Odin's man, though. It's all about wisdom now for me, rather than dying gloriously in battle. Although if that happens, that happens too. But it's about transformation. It's about becoming more. It's about being more. It's about becoming more and then serving the people, serving the folk.
Well, exactly, and that's one of the reasons, of course, why Odin in itself, in not only a lot of the depictions but the descriptions itself, he has a one eye is the one-eyed man, right? Because one is turned inward. It's a contemplative, a wisdom character, a kind of a shaman, if you will. And this is something also we need to talk a little bit about, that there is a kind of a belief that Europe and Europeans don't have, that they are not a native culture of sorts, that they are somehow, wherever they went, they were invaders or something like that. You know, this idea that there is a tremendous amount of material there to just pour into. And this is, of course, Norse mythology also true. That's not the only one in Europe. They're tremendous, a lot of them, and a lot of them do have correlations between them and interesting characters that seem to mimic very much of the same traits, etc. But there's just so many things to the cosmology in itself, which is just fascinating. Do you think that we've kind of lost connection with this? And if you could describe a little bit more, what do you think is some of the reasoning for us to kind of begin to look at some of this again, as it seems like Christianity is kind of slowly just withering away to a certain extent? This is something that's been with us for a long, long, long time, right? It's not something that's passed away either, I think.
Ooh, there's so many things in what you've just said that I want to comment on. I'm going to have to backtrack a little bit. I think that the common assumption, an unconscious assumption, but a very real one nevertheless, is that the peoples of Europe are somehow different in that our religions are not really native religions, that, you know, we're sort of like the social default. We don't really have a culture. We're seen as the oppressors. We're seen as people who were in many ways simple barbarians who lacked sophistication or spiritual depth. And this is profoundly irritating to me because I think it is just plain wrong. If you look at the old beliefs, and I think it's important perhaps at this juncture to say that when we use the term mythology, I don't think of made up stories to scare children or to support the priest class. I think that myth is that way by which we say that which cannot be said. It is much like poetry in that regard. Perhaps you could say that the mythology of a people is their dream. It's their deeper consciousness. It's that inner life that they have. And so I often avoid the use of the word mythology because everybody just assumes, oh, well, that's made up stuff, you know, as opposed to this wonderful, sophisticated, great, quote, great religions, unquote. But to me, I think of mythic lore. This is our inner depths. And it's assumed that ours is, in fact, superficial, and that's wrong. Everyone wants to quote, for example, Taoism or some other belief or the American Indian belief and say, oh, well, here's the real stuff. Here's depth. Here's wisdom. You know, we don't have that because everybody still thinks we're Christians. But if you look at it, you know, there are terms in Old Norse, and I won't even attempt to speak any Old Norse with any degree of accuracy, but there are terms for all of the things that you find in these other systems. I mean, everyone kind of understands that prana and ki and chi are all essentially the energy, but they don't realize that the northern peoples had a term for that. They had the term for it. They had ways of manipulating it. It all goes back to Odin. In fact, the name Odin isn't really a name. It's a title. And it means the master of the other, the inspired ecstatic state, and so forth. So, you know, we often overlook that. We don't see that which is right under our noses about the sophistication and the level of development of northern religion.
Well, absolutely. Good point. And maybe we could just talk a little bit about the cosmology overall of the creation myth. And again, I'm just to reemphasize here, there's so much material as well. And I think people are not really accustomed to thinking about all the sources that we can pour out from the Edda, you know, from the sources of Snorri Sturlason in Iceland. And there's just so many different sagas as well that have pieced all of this together, including the runestones themselves. But you have wonderful literature like Beowulf, for example, that all have contributed to this, that are now have painted a quite, you know, a sophisticated story for a culture that we've heard didn't have any written literature. So what do we know about the world of the Norse and the creation and all these wonderful things, Stephen?
Well, we actually know quite a lot. Those of us who follow the old ways today sometimes are accused of not having enough foundational material to work with. They say, oh, well, that was all lost, you know, or no, all of that that came after was Christianized by Snorri and so forth. And actually, I disagree with that rather strongly for reasons we can get into at some point.
Right.
But we actually know a pretty good amount. We have linguistic analysis. We have cross-cultural or say a Jungian sort of perspective of looking at the unconscious and the way that imagery is dealt with in cultures like the ones we're talking about. And I hasten to add that the cultures of Europe are very closely related. The Germanic peoples, the Slavs, the Celts, all came out of that funnel beaker culture that pre-existed, so the later stuff. We know, for example, that the creation myths deal with a unification of opposites. You've got a world of fire, a world of ice, and in the midst is Ginnungagap. Now, that's sometimes translated as a yawning void, but I think a more accurate translation is magically charged void. And whenever I hear a term like magically charged void, I immediately think of things like quantum foam, zero point energy, matter and energy, continually changing places, matter popping into existence, out of existence, virtual particles, all that sort of stuff. I'm no physicist, but I can read the popular literature. There's much more going on here and much deeper stuff than we've generally been allowed to believe. You have the idea of fire and ice, the extremes coming together. You have actually an evolutionary sequence. You have a evolution along the lines of intelligence that occurs if you take the myths and kind of watch the as they go through these various stages. I won't go into the whole thing, but essentially you start off with very low consciousness, and then you get you have Ymir and you have Alhumla and you have all of this, which is rather low in consciousness. Then you have the giants. And then you've got Odin and his brothers who essentially rearrange the cosmos and who put consciousness on a much higher level. So you have an evolution that, as it says in the Eddas, took place over, very vast periods of time. We're not talking a 7-day pull it out of a box kind of a thing.
Right.
So I think there's a lot there. It's not really my specialty, but I know enough about it to see that, wow, you've got a magically charged void, you've got the unification of opposites, you've got an evolutionary sequence towards higher states of consciousness. There's a lot there. I mean, it's something that can't really be dismissed as just ignorant savages by anybody who's looked at it with any depth.
Well, exactly. Absolutely right. And what do you think about the question of origins? Certainly a lot of people have speculated over the years of where this came from, if there was indeed an invasive force or a migrating force that eventually went up further north. What I found interesting in this is that there seems to have been a tremendous outpouring of different peoples from Scandinavia. I mean, I've just looking at some of them that you talked about, from the Lombards to the Vinlinians to the Gepids to the, they're just Burgundians. If you just do some kind of peripheral looking at some of them, you realize that a lot of their own creation myths and stories go back to that they migrated from Northern Europe and then further down. And then consequently, of course, you've had migration periods among, in different waves from that. But what do you think when it comes to origins? How far back do we have to go in human history to kind of get some kind of idea of where, when all of this began and when that kind of mindset and the creation myths and everything were starting up, Stephen?
I think it's probably rather hard to tie all of that down with any sort of precision. However, and in your introduction, you said that perhaps it was a little unusual to have an American commenting on ancient events in Europe. And as you said that, I thought, my ancestors have been in America for, call it 200 years. My ancestors have been in Europe for, let's call it, 40,000 years.
Exactly, yeah.
And 200 years is nothing compared to that. I am essentially, in every matter that that any matter that, that amounts to anything at all, I am a European who's living here in America. The bones of my ancestors are ground up beneath the glaciers. It's something that ties us together, and it's something that gives us depth in our lives. And as to where all of this begins in terms of, you know, the development of theories or beliefs, I can't really say. I know that the years are very long and the ages are very long. And I think that there's a continuity in terms of ultimate origins. I'll listen to whatever the scientists want to tell me about that. But I know that here and now, I'm a man of my particular branch of the human race, with the task of being true to my ancestors.
Very good. Now, we could run through some of the essences, the deities, whatever we want to call them, the people. There is, of course, an idea that these were at some point actually real people that lived, and this is how the stories have been passed down through the generations, and the ancestors consequently have been worshipped as gods. In many other stories of the formulation of the nations or even certain areas in Scandinavia, you realize that there was an important king, for example, that the area or the region was named after, in other words, suggesting that it was a real king at some point, and he actually existed, and his ancestors, through the genetics, if you will, through the blood, had the connection with him by venerating him or her in that manner. But what are some of your favorite characters that comes out in the? You of course mentioned Odin, but there's just tons of them. You know, this is a polytheistic religion. It's not the one god and monotheistic. This is, you have so many different to choose from. It's in that regard, a beautiful rainbow of diversity within this religion.
Absolutely.
If you will. You know.
Yeah. Well, Odin, of course, is first with me, but there are many intriguing characters amongst the gods and goddesses in our pantheon. Thor, of course, is rather commonly known. There was the comic book, and as degrading as that sounds, at least it made the name familiar.
Right.
There are the movies that have come out, you know, and I saw the first one that came out just, a couple years back, and while it was certainly not an accurate or aware version of our mythology, nevertheless, I thought the fellow who played Thor did a really nice job of it. They should have had his beard red instead of blonde, but he did capture that sort of strength combined with a friendly manner. Thor is described as, you know, the friend of men. He's the god who likes to feast, to drink. He's very convivial. He can stand a good joke. He's the working man's god in many ways. Freyr, of course, connected with the harvest very strongly. And so here's a deity that gives life, that brings life to the fields. And Freya, you know, his twin, who is the female embodiment of life-giving and of love and of lust and of pleasure and of all those things, those comforting things that make life under harsh circumstances endurable and even desirable. And you have many others. You have many others, some of them very mysterious. Some of them we don't know very much about. Some of them may be, in fact, the other deities that we know under different names. You know, scientists, archaeologists, philologists are always looking at place names and trying to decipher, well, was this that god or was it someone else or whatever.
Right.
So it's a colorful lot, you know. As you said, it's very diverse in every respect. There's something there. When I say there's something for everyone, I don't mean that in the sort of silly sense that people say it about so many things these days. But there is every aspect of the cosmos, to one extent or another, echoed, reflected, embodied in these gods and goddesses.
Now we have, as I said, different classes of the gods, if you will, then, and they come through in such a way that they seem to suggest we look at the records that we've had major conflicts as well as these came together. You have, of course, the major one of the Osir Vanir War that people can, you know, you can even go to Wikipedia and get a, like a basic overview of what some of these conflict, what they led to, etc. But do you think that some of this suggests that we had it is evidence of ancient migrations of people, and this is when different cultures kind of came together or clashed? Or is it more of a transcendent story? Do they represent something else on the mythological level, shall we say?
I lean more towards the latter explanation. And the reason for that is simply that you have Georges Dumézil, who came up with the whole idea of a tripartite Indo-European society with a corresponding pantheons that sort of matched that society. And he analyzed, of course, the Germanic beliefs, but also, you know, the Romans, the Celts, and so forth, you know, the whole Indo-European family, really. And he drew comparisons from all of these related mythologies. And he points out that the Isir-Vanir War, its equivalent occurs in Rome and in here and in there and so forth, that you had this sort of a thing. So I'm not saying it's impossible that it represented some sort of an actual migration. You know, certainly that's possible. But I think there's a lot to be said for the idea that we're talking about something that is more transcendent, more structural, something that deals with the fundamental, in some senses, antagonism, and in other senses, harmony between the deities of fertility and fecundity on the one hand, and those involved with martial prowess and the priest class on the other. There's some sort of an interaction there that seems to work its way through in all of our related cultures in a way that is somewhat similar, perhaps.
Well, exactly. I mean, I'm thinking about the story of, and this is have comparisons in Zoroastrianism, Vedic mythology, etc. There's this picture of the Altunblada, the it's a sacred cow, basically. I mean, that's, and people think of Hinduism when they think about this, but this is a cow that licks out, you know, one of the characters of out of the ice, and while Ymir, another these are two you know, twins, if you will, are suckling, you know, the milk from this sacred cow. In that regard, I mean, that has tremendous just comparisons to other religions as well, you know?
Yes, yes. Ultimately, when it comes down to the question of gods and goddesses, I puzzled for many years to try to get a handle on the nature of the gods, the nature of the goddesses. To what extent are these what the average man would call real? My personal experience with them is that, yes, the world acts as though the gods and goddesses are, quote, real. There's very strange things that happen when you call upon them. The universe responds in a definite way that's in keeping with that idea. And so I spent a long time trying to rationalize that. Well, you know, gee, if the gods are real, how about this? How about that? And, you know, finally, I think I have reached a different level on it. I now think of the gods simply as mysteries, with a capital M. It's like the idea of the runes. Some of your listeners will be familiar with runes. Runes are the sacred symbolic script of the Germanic peoples. There were several different, quote, alphabets, unquote, of runes. Each rune has a particular name, and it's associated with a certain concept, a hidden secret concept. In fact, the word rune actually in most Germanic languages means a mystery, a sacred mystery, that which is beyond comprehension. So when I read a book on runes and it says, well, the rune Reiro means da 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 da, or the rune Perthro means da 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 da, I shake my heads, because those things are not what the rune means. Those are things that we associate with the rune. And I think this is the way it is with the gods. We could suppose we had had an object that we did not understand and we wanted to explore and we wanted to define, you know, that rationalistic thing of ours of let's define it all. And let's say, like it was a piece of sculpture in the middle of a gallery and we wanted to analyze, to define, to dissect that. Well, if I stand over here, I can analyze that in a particular way. And in the terms of the runes or the gods, I'd be looking at, well, what is the meaning of the name of that god or of that rune? Or I could take it from a different angle. If I walk around a little bit to the other side, well, we can analyze the gods in terms of myths or this particular rune in terms of the rune poems. Or if I take it a little bit farther around the circle so that I'm on the other side of this mysterium in the middle, I can say, well, I'm going to analyze it now in terms of my personal experiences. But ultimately, I can describe, but I cannot define. The runes remain mysteries by definition. They are mysteries with a capital M. And the gods are mysteries with a capital N. I have interacted with them. They have interacted with me, if you will. But what are they? They are mysteries. But I feel that they are an integral part of who and what I am at the same time as they are part of the larger universe. They are something that corresponds to a very deep level within me and which calls to me and which I trust because I know that it is in fact, in essence, bound, connected, wedded to all that I am.
Do you think that our...
Roll there, didn't you?
Well, it's great. You know, no, it's great. Do you think that our mind, and it's not only the mind, it's more to it than that, but to simplify it, do you think that our mind is a different one today than it was then when this potentially could be understood? Or is this still something that we can understand if we give ourselves to it? I mean, that's what I'm getting from when you're talking a little bit about it, that this is something that still speaks to you. It's not dead. It's not gone. Far from it. This is something that's very much, it's been, you know, bubbling under the surface for many, many hundreds of years now, and it's waiting for us, right?
I would say so, definitely. A gentleman named Colin Cleary wrote a book called Summoning the Gods, and it's very well put together, and he talks about the change in consciousness. Not an inherent change, but a change in the way we use our consciousness and develop our consciousness in the modern age. And he says that if we even have to ask ourselves the question of, quote, are the gods real, then we're missing that intimacy.
Exactly, yep.
Yeah, that to ask it is to divide, to be, it's, you know, Schrodinger's cat or something, you know.
Yeah.
There we go. You know, is the cat dead or alive? Are the gods real or not? Well, it all depends on the observer, doesn't it? And he says one thing that one has to do is to, as much as one can, and this is difficult for many of us in today's world, we must expose ourselves to nature. The gods are the gods of nature.
Yes.
And if we live in an artificially constructed world, it's going to be very difficult, perhaps, to have those sorts of experiences, those sorts of insights. And I do know that, just speaking for myself, I've had far more religious experiences in the forest than I ever had inside a church or a building of any kind, for that matter.
Yeah.
yeah.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. They represent properties in our world. This was the scientific method of the day to understand how the world works, what is out there, the different things that how nature works. I mean, it's an intricate component to how we survive with everything that's out there, right? This is very much a grounded thing, although we today have a disconnected idea from it and think, oh, this is just something that's weird of, it's part of some weird kind of mindset, and it doesn't really make sense to us, right? But we are the foreigners to it today. We are the ones who are disconnected from these very properties and spirits and forces in nature.
I would agree with that, and I think I would go farther. You mentioned shamanism a while ago, and I noticed that in societies that have some sort of a shamanic base, which is many, many of your archaic tribal beliefs and systems. If a person is acting very peculiarly, if they are a little deranged, if they are ill, but not simplistically ill, if there's something really in them that needs to be set right, you know, the shaman will enter the other world and go to recover the soul, because the whole idea is that the soul has gone wandering and needs to be brought back to the person, essentially. And, of course, it's very easy to laugh at that and say, oh, what a bunch of stupid people, you know, we'll buy their pottery, but we think they're a little crazy after all. And they're not nearly as good as us Westerners because, hey, you know, we've got iPhones. But, in fact, I think it is possible for entire cultures, entire peoples to lose their soul, to have their soul go wandering. And I think that has what happened, and it continues to be the case with the peoples of Europe. We have been separated from everything that we essentially are. We have been cut off from our ancestors, told our ancestors don't matter. We've been told that our history is a farce. We've been told we are not really a people. We're not like indigenous. You know, we're just, you know, the default.
Yep.
And because we have internalized that crap, we are ill in a sense. We are disturbed. We are not completed. We must find our souls again. We must reconnect with the sources of ancestral wisdom. We must reconnect with those holy powers, those mysteries that move in nature and in our own inner beings. And until we do that, we are ill. And, you know, it's not just us. I think that it's especially bad with the European-descended peoples because, you know, we produced so much of science and technology and, you know, that sort of formalistic structure. But to some extent, it applies to everybody. I worked in a youth facility with troubled youths. And there was a young man out there who I only found out after long conversations with him, is a member of a local tribe Native Americans. And he was clearly a bothered youth. And I said to him, seek out the ways of your people. You know, I said, how about your grandfather? And he said, well, yeah, my grandfather still hunts according to the old customs. And I said, well, there's a start. How about your great-grandfather? And he said, oh, well, my great-grandfather had quite a lot more knowledge. And I said, if you're going to be whole, you need to seek out that. That is your context. That is your root. And it is the same with us. It is the same with those of us who are German, English, Irish, Scandinavian. We, too, have been dispossessed. We have been robbed of our heritage. We allowed ourselves to be robbed of our heritage in many cases, and now we're paying the price. Now we must fix it.
I want to clarify that point about the loss of our the connection to our roots and what that actually does with us as well. I mean, we can talk about that for a little bit. And just something that has to be faced in this is that there is a self-resentment for some reason in this. There is even seems to be a guilt associated with it. I don't know what to call it, really, but it's something that has happened, and I see this in Northern Europe specifically all the time. It kind of, we hear politicians speak in this way. We hear the mainstream media speaking in this way, and this goes, the depths and the roots of this thing goes really, really deep in there, and I'm always wondering why. You know, what is the case here, this kind of a rejection of where we do come from? It's almost like we're not allowed to have an identity. And I think that might be something, might be difficult for someone from the outside just to get, maybe see that. But again, as I'm trying to examine that in further detail, specifically with my fellow Swedes and Norwegians and Danes and Finns and Icelanders and everything else, I realize that something has happened there and something has changed in that capacity. And obviously our societies is, although there's hailed as role models in the media, unfortunately, the real truth of the matter is that these are slowly decaying societies now, where birth rates are dropping and people are just completely lost from their past and their root system. But Is there any way we can get closer to understanding what has happened there and why this has happened?
I think we can speak academically about why all of that happened. But the only thing that will get us out of this is a realization on a deeper level. For example, something else I tell the kids where I work, and this applies, you know, to all of them, you know, not any particular origins, but all of them.
Right.
I say, look, you got to understand, you are the last in a long line of winners. Every single one of your ancestors lived long enough at least to reproduce, despite famine, war, disease, and so forth. They survived. That essence, that power still lives in you. The ancestors in all traditional communities are still a part of the community. We've cut ourselves off from that with our materialism and our lack of insight. We need to ultimately rearrange our spiritual priorities and to realize that we are connected, that we've never lost that connection in potential, but that we have deafened ourselves with the materialism and the, in many ways, the degeneracy of our time. We need to recover tradition and to do that in a way that is intelligent and thoughtful.
And if we don't?
If we don't, we'll cease to exist. That long line of ancestors will come to an end because we won't feel we're worth preserving.
You know? Yeah, yeah. Oh, boy. Well, this is something I want to talk more about, and of course, we have much more to cover. We're just scraping the surface here and just kind of trying to get a big overview here of all the different things and the components to this story of sorts, Stephen. But before we take a break here and continue to talk more in the second segment, let's talk a little bit about some of your websites, some of the organizations that you're part of. Just give out some details where people can, you know, follow you, follow your work, and of course, talk more if there's something that you have upcoming or whatnot. So please, give us all the details.
Okay. Well, our main website is runestone.org, runestone.org, all run together. And that is the website of the Asa True Folk Assembly, which is an organization that I founded. In fact, it's coming up on its 20th anniversary next year. I have, of course, a Facebook page set up for that, and you can go in and like our Facebook and page and follow us there. We also use Twitter. I post to all of these various media typically about four times a week, depending on my schedule at the job that pays the bills. And I'd be very pleased if people would like to drop in and pay us a visit.
Very good. We'll have this linked up there as well. And, of course, runestone.org, that's the main website, but there's a couple other ones. We'll have that up as well. All right, Stephen, well, stay with us then. We'll take a short break. We'll return shortly. Much more Norse mythology and Asa Tru coming up. We'll pick up with Stephen McNallan in the second hour after the break here. We have a fascinating conversation continuing here about the Norse way, Viking raids, conflict with Christianity. But we'll also talk about the various sources of material, the magic of the runes, and we continue to address the deeper levels of what weaknesses a rootless human actually produce. We are talking about one who fits perfectly into the brackets of control of the modern age of purposelessness and scientific chance. We also talk about the concept that we are somehow morally superior today and that we are at the pinnacle of advancement. But the question is where all of this will lead us tomorrow. This is a political laboratory, and most people have no clue that they have broken thousands of years of tradition and way of life, the way of their ancestors, and in a flight of rebellion induced by the social engineers, replaced all of that beautiful generational unfoldment for a Walmart personality. Much more is coming up. We continue at redicemembers.com, the website where you can hear the second hour of our programs and, of course, get the full archives back to the start of the radio show in 2006, including the videos, the films, the TV episodes, commentary, music, and a lot of other stuff. Mark Gray, John B. Wells, and Johnny Enoch on Radio 314 are some of our upcoming guests. Thank you for staying with us as we continue with Stephen McNallan on RedIceMembers.com. Thank you for listening.